And artists, I like to say, change the way we see the world. And so they have they're in a special category, I think, in most cultures. We have a reverence for artists, and we not only revere their skills, but also their ability to interpret and to understand what's happening. So I'm actually going to predict there are going to be some very interesting things coming out of this pandemic period in terms of artwork.
Well, on that note, I want to welcome you, Stephanie Stevish, to The Women. I'm your host, Rose Reed. And my guest today is the director of the Smithsonian Museum, someone with an infectious appreciation for the arts. And Stephanie, can you introduce yourself?
Sure. I'm Stephanie Stevish. I have an endowed position, so I like to say I'm the Margaret and Terry Stent Director of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, which is part of the Smithsonian, which is the largest museum, education, and research center in the world. So I'm leading actually two museums. I lead the American Art Museum, and I lead the Renwick Gallery, which is our National Museum of Craft, a block from the White House.
Stephanie has been in the art world her entire life. Before coming to Washington, D.C., she was the executive director at the Tacoma Art Museum for about 15 years, and she was also the assistant director at the Minneapolis Institute of Arts and assistant director at the Cleveland Museum of Art. Stephanie got her bachelor's degree in art history from Columbia University and her master's in modern art from the Institute of Fine Arts at New York University. One of Stephanie's priorities is getting more people to experience art in real life. And she grew attendance from 2 million to just about 3 million visitors annually before the pandemic shutdown. Stephanie's the daughter of German immigrants, and she speaks both German and French. We spoke over Zoom. You're the daughter of German immigrants, and you grew up in Scarsdale, New York, and your mom was also an art historian, and I believe worked at the Brooklyn Museum, which is actually just a few miles from where I'm recording today. I imagine that you kind of feel like at home in museums, like Eloise in a hotel.
Yes, well said. So I'm German by birth and American by choice. I grew up here. I came as a small child, really root ourselves in this wonderful country. And I was lucky to have parents with very different interests and enthusiasms that they shared with me and my two brothers. So my father was very sporty. So we would spend a lot of time doing exercise, and you get a sense of both team play in soccer, as you might imagine as a German, and my mother as an art historian. So plenty of time spent going to museums. We did revolt a little on going to too many cathedrals when we were traveling, both back in Germany or traveling around Europe a little bit. And it was a great gift, and it's something I try to do maybe with some ice cream rewards when I'm with my nieces and nephew and I take them through museums.
You've described your father as a refugee and displaced from World War II. And one of the things that you have quoted him saying to you is, "What you put in your head, no one can take away from you." Would you be able to share the context around him coming to this realization and sharing it with you?
Sure. So my father was a ethnic German minority in what is now the Czech Republic. And so with the assault on the Sudetenland by Hitler, and then, of course, the Russians coming in 1945 and pushing people out, my father was first displaced, and then he was a refugee. He would go to Austria until the Austrians kicked you out, and then he came to Germany, ended up on a farm, which was good because there was work and there was food and there was housing, and his education was disrupted during this time. He both skipped grades and missed a great deal of school, and as the only boy among two sisters, it was his education that was prized. And so he got a watch from the people who owned the farm. My grandmother was a cook. She, you know, middle-class circumstances change after a war. And she was a single mother with her own mother and living on a farm as a cook. So he got a farm for his, he got a watch for his good grades. And only he would go to university in Munich. And so he always valued education. It was very important to him. And when I went to school, my father would have us sit there and we'd have to watch him sign the check for our tuition. And he lost everything. I mean, it was, you know, you had an hour to take everything you could carry, and then your house was gone, never to return. So that made a big impression. Those were stories. My mother was born in 42, so she actually played in the rubble of Germany. So she had a different experience. My father was 10 when he lost his home. So there were certainly more possibilities for our family here in America. Even though my father was a businessman in Germany, there were still possibilities for my mother to go to school, to make a career for herself. And as women had different opportunities and privileges in America. And for us to go to school here too, but always keeping up our German heritage. I think that's a great point of pride for Americans. Where do you come from? Where does your family come from? And that again is a commonality of the American experience. And then the other wonderful thing I love about America, in Europe, often you're rooted in place. You know, your family has always lived here, kind of sentiment, of course, aside from the wartime refugee situations and whatnot. But in America, we move all the time. We you know, so sometimes you go to college, sometimes you move for a job, your family moves for a whole host of reasons. And it gives you this sense of the expansiveness of the differences. I mean, so as I've moved across the country, I've become a great cheerleader for the Midwest, or there's something special about the Pacific Northwest. And I think something quite wonderful about the District of Columbia. You have to come to the Smithsonian. It is the Museum of the People. It is free. We're open remarkably 7 days a week, every single day, except Christmas. And now we have two museums coming. I mean, you know, it's incumbent upon everyone as an American to come to Washington, D.C. more than once in a lifetime, because it is a changing city. And it is a place also we ask ourselves, who are we as Americans? And I think our cultural organizations, we also are places where we ask ourselves and others questions. What does it mean to be an American? What are we proud of as Americans? How do we reckon with the dark chapters of the American story?
You know, as the child of immigrants, as the child of someone displaced by war, as someone who is openly gay, how do you think that your personal identity has impacted your approach and your strategies to being an art historian?
So when I approached art history, I love, somebody once asked me, you know, what art do you love? And I was a little shocked. I said, I like all art. I'm really interested in again, that's expanse, that history of art. I'm the current steward of the American Art Collections, you know, for future generations as well. I'm a fan of the underdog. And so what I love about this museum is we have a very expansive definition about what art is. We have folk artists and self-taught artists. We have American artists who have lived, worked, studied abroad, but have an Americanness that we prize, like a John Singer Sargent. We have artists who were teachers, but also maybe were better understood later in their lives, like Alma Thomas from D.C., influenced many artists. We have many works as an estate gift. We have artists, again, who work in very democratic media, print artists. We have a great exhibition on now, Printing the Revolution, The Rise and Impact of Chicano Graphics, 1965 Today. How's that for something timely? The issues that these artists were highlighting through their creative skills are still with us today. Police brutality, poor working conditions, the pay inequity, people who were overlooked and marginalized, want to make sure that we spotlight more women artists, want to make sure that we surprise people also when they come in, that they see both the familiar, what they're expecting in American art, and again, offer them some wonder about how expansive and spectacular American art is.
You know, you oversee about 43,000 objects. You manage a $20+ million budget, and you essentially are a steward, not just for the building, but for the different histories. Can you talk about how people who are in charge of curating can impact what's curated and how you're thinking about that in terms of diversity and inclusion?
I think it's a very exciting time to lead museums, art museums, science museums, history museums. I do think that people, more than ever before, learn in different ways. So today, as America becomes ever more diverse, it's more incumbent on museums to make sure that the stories we tell are ones that resonate. So we've been always collecting what other people think are important. So early on in the 1970s, we took in huge collections of African-American art. When other museums said no, that we don't really see this or value this quite the same way that they may value other kinds of artworks. We valued craft, also something that other museums have not focused on. We have quilt collections. We have collections of photography. Again, photography only recently was worth collecting by museums, only in the last 50 years or so. So I would say because we're the National Collection of American Art, we've had a very open definition of art, and we've really tried to always include all the American voices. And again, Puerto Rican artists, Native American work, mostly Native American contemporary, because at the Smithsonian we have two museums that have a focus on American Indian artworks and culture.
And can you describe the history behind the Patent Office?
Yes. So the Smithsonian American Art Museum is one of the grand buildings in Washington, D.C. It's two city blocks long.
It's okay. That's life, okay. That's life. At home. People have dogs. People have families.
Yes. Let me introduce you to Felicitas and Artemis, my constant companions. Anyway, the historic old patent office building, again, is located between F and G Streets and 7th and 9th. And it was the third oldest federal building in the United States. You have to imagine that. The White House, the Capitol, and why would you have a patent office being such an important building? Well, when Andrew Jackson signs the patent legislation, it is to ensure that the incredible creativity, America is a nation of makers, of builders, of creators, that this kind of economic engine in really solidifying when somebody has a patent, has an original idea, has created something that they can now hopefully better society in some way or make things more efficient, that would be appreciated and respected by the government. And it was built, begun in the 1836-37 with various waves for the building, which was, again, also intended to be fireproof. Because to get a patent, you not only had to fill out the form and describe what you've created, but you have to make a little model. You have to actually show the proof of concept, whether it's a flip-out bed or an extension ladder or a gin mill or anything else. So you have to make a little model. The building also includes two other Smithsonian siblings, this portrait gallery and then the Archives of American Art.
This is one of the things that I find so fascinating about museums as places for both recognition and reckoning, and this interesting tension of how we look at history. You know, for example, Andrew Jackson made sure that innovation was protected at the same time the Trail of Tears and pushing out Native Americans and supporting slavery and genocide. We see just in the history of a museum how it can bring these themes to a surface. What have you seen in this last year during the Black Lives Matter movement? What designs or plans have you seen by artists that you think really address our reckoning and our recognition in new ways?
I think we're at a moment of reckoning. I think you've described that very well, and our secretary certainly talks about that. And he sees that we at the Smithsonian have a role. We cannot run away from history. We have to present history maybe in all its all the facets of it. So you can imagine historic objects in a museum often have new readings. We have to make room for example, for different portraits, for different figures. We have to make room for different artists who can offer us more provocative views of things. And so artists, even in historic times, would bring these issues up. Sometimes we are not able to read the images quite so well. So the work of curators today is to look at these objects and, again, try to tease out the most important as well as relevant parts of the story. You know, why does this picture speak to us in a new way? So, for example, we just had our wonderful Robert Duncanson landscape with rainbow as part of the joint inaugural committee celebration. And this was a painting selected both by Senator Roy Blunt and Dr. Jill Biden. And symbols matter in America, and that they would use an artwork from the American Art Museum matters as well. This is an African-American artist coming from Cincinnati. The Duncanson painting, you know, who is this artist making this artwork? What is this moment, and why should we have hope? And again, it's from 1859. This is an image that also reminds us of the Civil War, a very divisive period. And again, to pick this painting, it operates on many levels. And let's not forget beauty. Beauty is important. At least it pulls you in. But sometimes I would tell you things that are not beautiful might challenge you. And so museums, again, have to keep a balance and have to make important decisions. The most important decision we make is which artworks to bring into the national collections. The next most important question is, how do we display them appropriately to honor the artists, to honor the intent, and put them in conversation with other artworks and invite our visitors to fall in love with the works? It's really the encounter with the visitor that we're always thinking about. Mm-hmm. And of course, as we move artworks around, they take on different meanings. They're in relationship for different works. So when we buy a contemporary piece, like by Fred Wilson, who does this beautiful black mirror of sorts, and we put it in a 19th century gallery with a sort of super white marble sculptures. You know, what is that conversation? How are we seeing ourselves as a visitor in a black mirror made by a black artist talking about Shakespeare? You know, when it works, it's magical, and I think that's why people come to museums. They are looking for the wonder. I think they're also looking to understand themselves and hopefully others better too. So how we display things and what we select tells a lot about us and hopefully speaks to the moment we're living in. You know, we're living in a, you know, double pandemic, one as old as this country and one novel.
Balance is a tightrope that so many stewards and artists and archivists, and especially museums, are navigating. You know, you have this almost like a seesaw relationship between representation and atonement, or a paradox relationship between things that are stagnant and things that are progressing. You know, as a Southerner, and I'm a seventh generation Georgian, two of my ancestors fought in the Confederacy, and there's still so much that I don't know, and I think so much that has not been passed down. You know, one of the things that we're seeing right now is this public reckoning with our sculptures and our art and public spaces. You know, we see Confederate sculptures being taken down, sometimes in the middle of the night without new placards coming up to explain conversations. We see public dissent over how to handle these remnants of the Confederacy, but really remnants of our tension, because a lot of these statues were erected after, you know, major progress, like the passing of the Voting Rights Act or the passing of the Civil Rights Act. And I was wondering if you've seen models or plans that contemporary artists, Black artists, are recommending or putting forward to commemorate, build upon, or alter these areas where these public statues either have been or currently are. You know, I was recently in Atlanta, and there are probably 50 statues like that within a 4-mile radius. It's really an interesting opportunity for the artists, like you say, to show us ways in which we can reimagine these spaces.
I think it's very important that we're paying more attention to civic spaces. Public spaces are meant for everyone. And so these decisions, often from long ago, to place objects that are supposed to speak to community values but somehow don't, maybe we weren't vocal enough at the time that they didn't really include everyone. But today we're very aware of that. This has been a topic of interest for us at the Smithsonian American Art Museum for some time. We did a community-based national survey of sculpture called SOS, Save Outdoor Sculpture.
That's such an interesting title, SOS. I love
SOS,
that play.
Yes. Yeah, the program was initiated in 89 and it ended about 10 years later. And the beauty of it was community-based. It was about identifying, photographing, and often recognizing if something needed conservation work. And we worked with the Girl Scouts and the Rotarians and everyone else. And it, again, made people aware of civic spaces and art that was outside of the museum. What's interesting is that I think people have clearly differentiated between sculpture that is in museums, where, again, we have the ability to change the context. We have the ability to change the label quickly. Mm. And it is not really in public space that you're forced to walk past as you are the park on your way to work or church or temple or your friend's home. So public space, I think, is much more freighted, so to speak. And there's, again, a question of sort of who owns this public space. Now, my field of interest and specialty is modern art. So certainly with modern sculpture, there's been a lot of debate. You think about the Richard Serra tilted arc, how it cut off a federal plaza downtown, and what kind of a debate that created. But with historic figures, again, it's always whose story, who are we really putting on a pedestal? And of course, now we are pulling them off a pedestal. I think the best answer, the best answer is going to come from the community itself. I don't think anybody should be coming in, certainly not the Smithsonian, telling people what to do with their public sculpture. We'd right. be happy to be part of the conversation if you invite us.
Right. That's why I was curious if you've seen any artist specific recommendations. And so I don't know if that's
yes.
still really new.
Yeah, I think there are a number of conversations going on. So I do think if one can have a civic debate about this, and again, it's a great education for everybody in the community. And so I think the way to go is both fostering understanding, you know, what is it that we have here? And then second, does it still represent us? And could we add? I'm an art historian, so I like to keep things. but I think that history and artists tell us new stories. So I'm in favor of adding other works to open up different chapters of a story. Now, also there are objects that are really offensive to many, images that remain hurtful today, just as there are words we don't use that are truly hurtful. And for those objects like sculptures, I think the place are history museums. And again, they can tell a better story. And we've seen some examples where works have been removed and the destination is a history museum.
During your previous post, before you were in your current role at the Smithsonian, you were at Tacoma, Washington. You spent 12 years there. You know, I think you raised over $35 million. You oversaw renovation, the increase of more than 2,000 artworks. You added the art of local residents and jewelry by Northwest artists, adding Chihuly glass. I didn't even know that Chihuly was from the Washington area.
Tacoma, Washington, yes, his hometown. Very proud of that.
I can just imagine that there are so many stakeholders and people that you have to work across internally, externally. Can you give one example of a time where you decided that something was a priority for the museum, persevered, some pushback How did you negotiate that, and what was that like for you?
Over 12 years, certainly there are plenty of stories. Again, another important role is, what exhibitions do you either create out of your own collections? Do you highlight which artists you think are important? And then also, which exhibitions do you bring to a community? The Tacoma Art Museum would bring, on an annual basis, a major show featuring artists that we simply didn't have in our collection, or that with themes that we thought were important. And some days, again, Rose, you got to get lucky. Museum directors are often talking about what projects are going on. We keep an eye on when art jumps out of the arts and leisure section and jumps onto the front page when there's a controversy. There was a major show called Hide, Seek, Difference, and Desire in American Portraiture. And it was also a difficult political moment, and a number of people seized the exhibition, one particular work, by an artist who's since died of AIDS, David Vonarovich, and a video he made and stated that had an anti-Catholic bias. Anyway, just to keep the story short. Anyway, this piece became controversial, and the demand by political leaders was to remove the work from the exhibition. Now, in the museum field, that's like ripping a page out of a book. All the works are selected, and they build upon each other. We have experts who've put the exhibition together. Who's to say what should be suddenly removed, let alone added? So anyway, this became a big national discussion. It was very difficult for the Smithsonian because it receives federal funding and whatnot. And ultimately, the piece was removed. Sadly, it was a bit of a black eye for the Smithsonian in retrospect. Mm-hmm. And then, interestingly, a group of artists took the video and rented a cargo container and parked it in front of the museum so you could go to the Museum of Uncensored Art and see the video. Anyhow, there's a big debate in the museum field. Again, this is this kind of political pressure censor an exhibition. And so, how do you address this? Well, the idea struck me that it would probably be good if more people could see the exhibition. If this was really an important topic, which actually was about gay identity in American portraiture, a very important topic, first time tackled, maybe others should see it. And we could bring the piece back into the show. And it was a big, complicated exhibition for a whole host of reasons. Anyway, then I also got lucky because on the ballot in Washington State was marriage equality.
Wow.
And so this
timing.
Exhibition, which was tough. I mean, the previous director in both D.C. and Brooklyn had gotten death threats for taking the exhibition. It really inflamed a lot of passions. And I had to prepare my board. I had to speak to donors about what really was in the exhibition, what wasn't. And then we would have a public program on evening, and you go back to your car, and your car would be filled with leaflets against, anti-gay marriage or whatever the upset was related to that exhibition or that group. So, and I had one of the most powerful board meetings. And also we got letters like we've never gotten before, which goes back to your question about representation. Who is seen in museums? Who's left out? And I think museums are really very eager to be as inclusive as possible. We're working very hard, again, to ask ourselves, to criticize ourselves about why is something missing in our story. And we have to redouble our efforts. Again, we talk a lot about how women artists, and there's a wonderful protest group, the Guerrilla Girls, and they've made wonderful posters saying, there are a lot of women depicted, at the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but mostly they're nudes, not women artists. Where are the women artists? Which is the great Linda Nochlin essay that really spurred a lot of reflection and change. So, again, you find that you're a bit of a community leader as an art museum director. I try to be accessible. I have great conversations. In Tacoma, I was a little bit better known as a smaller community. In the grocery aisles, hey, love that show. Oh, I really hated that exhibition. What were you thinking? Do you know this artist? So I love the civic quality. I'm a civic booster. And I've figured out that my home is in museums that are of a place. I worked at the Tacoma Art Museum, the Minneapolis Institute of Arts, the Cleveland Museum of Art, the Brooklyn Museum. I worked at the Brooklyn Museum. Love the Brooklyn Museum. Played there as a child, as my mother was a curator there for a special exhibition on Haitian art. Great Haitian community in Brooklyn. Not as visible in the museum until they did this special exhibition. So I think museums have a terribly important role to play. And I welcome both the criticism and the compliments, you know, when we get it right, because we have a lot of people who are working very hard, very diligently to get it right.
And you also have a very special love story rooted in art museums. I believe you've been married now 5 years?
Yes, almost 5 years. And certainly I kind of knew early on that art museums were my home. You know, art galleries, you'd have to sell the art. I wasn't really in favor of that. Auctions, kind of the same thing. Teaching was wonderful, but I didn't feel I could reach as many people as with the museum. So my career has had me hopscotch across the country and really became, in some cases, too much of the focus of my life. And I didn't give myself enough time for a fuller life. And so, lo and behold, as you see somebody differently, the director of the then American Folk Art Museum, Anna Melda Radice, and I had a conversation at a conference, and I saw her in a new light, and we found we had much in common. We had a lot of shared values, and we got married, and it was a bit of a geographic challenge because she was in New York City and I was in Tacoma, Washington.
I know, and it's also kind of like When Harry Met Sally. You knew each other for a long time, and then it became romantic, but it also has this Pride and Prejudice element of, you know, kind of holding back. You know, this is what I'm intuiting from, you know, devouring the vows section religiously from the New York Times. But,
yes.
You know, it seems really interesting to me that you decided within the span of a few months to get married.
Yeah, well, I'm new at marriage, so other people can tell me more about it. But I think later in life, you have a better sense of who you are and who might be a good partner in composing a life together. And of course, shared values mean a great deal in terms of, and yet we have plenty of differences, I assure you, that we continue to discover. So as my wife in many ways, was more prominent than me. And so I knew her from afar, usually sitting in the audience as she was giving a talk as the chair of the Institute of Museum and Library Services, or as the founding director of the National Museum of Women in the Arts. And now, again, she works for a federal agency, the NEH. And we're both in Washington, D.C. Hooray, hooray. I like to joke, she's much more popular. I always have to carry more of her business cards than my own because she actually gives money away. She's a grantor. I'm usually asking for money to support the activities of the museum. But we have a great time and we're each other's best cheerleaders.
So now that you've gone from being bi-coastal to working from D.C., New York, and now in D.C., and then with the pandemic, is this the most time you've spent together uninterrupted in the past year?
Yes, I think that might be true. So again, being fairly recently married, we still have lots of things to talk about. still getting to know each other and telling stories. We both like to play games, so we're very active with Yahtzee or Boggle or jigsaw puzzles, crossword puzzles or things like that. My wife also is an accomplished breeder of dachshunds, so dachshunds have entered my life. That's a lot to learn about. We joke a little. We become pioneer women. She makes applesauce and dries seeds, and I'm baking bread and baking dog biscuits. So it has been a slower, reflective time. And I think the question I think people personally, as well as professionally, struggle with is, what will be the new normal? Will we retain some of the best things that have come out of this very hard and sad time? Will we have a need to be connected? How do we continue to be part of communities? How do we find joy in small things? How do we slow down? Again, museums are good slow down places.
Indeed, they are.
I offer, and they're good social spaces. Much to the the upset of my California museum directors. Somebody in California seems to think it's a good idea to keep the museums closed, maybe thinking that museums are really only places of blockbusters where people from out of town come. Where really, we have often a lot of square footage. There's a lot of space. We like you to social distance from each other as well as the artworks. So, and frankly, we need mental health breaks. I mean, you can only be in your own four walls for so long. I think we, and going to museums, it's about something bigger than ourselves. And it may inspire, again, a lot of handicrafts. A lot of people have been knitting like crazy or drawing and sketching. So if we can find more ways to make people feel truly at home and welcome in museums, and sometimes a little uncomfortable as they learn new things too.
So for our lightning round, I like to say we go light after we go deep. It's called Truth or Truth. And these are quick fire questions, and they're a little bit fun. So when I prepared for this interview, I guess I should say that I also have a similar 3-month kind of situation, and that during COVID, I have met, fallen in love, and moved in with somebody.
Yay!
And after being pretty single for 10 years, I find myself in a very serious relationship for the first time. And I was wondering, as an adult, do you have any advice for a new relationship?
I'm going to quote an artist.
Appropriate.
Fear not. That is part of the James Hampton throne, one of the prized artworks in the museum, self-taught artist. And up top, and he creates his own religious environment with altars and whatnot. He says, fear not. I think we have to pick, choose love over fear.
Thank you. Thank you for that. And this also might be a little bit wacky and a personal projection, but do you find that a lot of people talk about that how museums are aphrodisiacs?
We at SAM have hosted Dating Lab, which for people who don't know that's a Washington Post column, which is delightful because I think we all imagine we might be matchmakers in some way. And so people who are looking for love write up and somehow they're matched up and then they go on a date, you know, usually at a restaurant. We've hosted them at the Art Museum, at the Smithsonian American Art Museum, because people go to museums on dates. And one of my favorite things is how many people actually get engaged at museums.
How, that's so touching.
So we used to charge a fee at the Tacoma Art Museum for like $100. We put a little ring in a box and clear people out, and you could have that moment. I would write the couple, some kind of note about love and art and such, and give them a catalog. And then, of course, people sometimes choose to get married at museums or have their anniversaries or something like that. So, yeah, I do think there's something. We can bring ourselves to an art museum in a different way, I'd offer, than a science museum. I mean, we're reading the facts, or maybe you can tell a story about when you saw fossils or whatever else. But there's a level of interpretation. You reveal something about yourself. You know, I'd like to say you see the world from where you sit. So again, it's the unique things that you bring to your position, and that the things your position affords you to do and to improve people's lives, I hope.
And for women out there who are thinking about, do I ascend to a higher role in my organization or company? Will I lose my connection to my craft? Am I qualified? What do you say to women in that position who are thinking about stepping into bigger roles?
Go for it. When you do more, you challenge yourself, you challenge others around you, and you actually have more people to help you. And actually, when you have more responsibility or power, whatever you call it, you actually get to make the rules, and you can make things better for others. Again, we're all paying it forward. I try to spend a good bit of my time always answering questions about, I'm starting off in a museum career, or I'm thinking about studying art history, whatever. I love those calls. I love those conversations about people wondering if the museum field is right for them. And it is. It is. Art museums are fabulous places. You can be a photographer. You can be organized as an accountant. You can track the movement of artworks as a registrar. You can make meaning for school children. You can do delightful community programs for thousands of people for the Lunar New Year. There are wonderful ways to bring your talents that really impact other people's lives. And I have to tell you, I work at a nonprofit. I call them social profits, right? My work is in service of my values. Yes, I get paid to do it, but I bring my values to work. And I think what we also do, particularly as women, we have to bring our whole selves to work. Everyone should bring their whole self to work.
The Women is a production of Rose Reed. This episode was mixed by Adrienne Lilly. We're going to be publishing every 2 weeks on Thursday, so check back in 2 weeks. I get a chance to talk to Jessica Nabongo, the first Black woman to travel to every country in the world.